Right. Okay, so welcome to this evening's live call, Wednesday, the 24th of June. Welcome, Mark.
Hello.
Okay, so as normal, just put up my contact details just to say I am here to help. Email chris@runcheeks.com and then my phone number you can WhatsApp me on. As usual. So for this evening, what I want to do is I want to go over some updates that I have for you, and we're going to look at the main topics are fatigue, what happens to your running, and then we're going to look at tension, so why you create tension when you run, and then we can kind of answer any questions that you might have about that. Okay, so updates first of all. So the new navigation panel is out. You've had the emails for that, which you should have your username and password. You can change the password by going up into the right-hand side. So the idea of that new navigation panel is just to make navigating the membership course platform a lot easier. You'll see also in there you've got an option to choose a pathway. You don't have to worry too much about that. That's kind of more moving on forward, but it does give you can choose that pathway, and then you can go and link into looking at the new onboarding course that's in there. So it's all new content in that onboarding course. It's called it's the Start Here module, and that goes over what the pathways are, which is basically the new simplified pathway, which is a 12-week movement challenge, which has been designed to improve your mapping, general movement as a kind of gentle introduction and get you moving sort of thing. We have the library or explore pathway that's been there from the beginning, which is basically follow the assessment module, find your lowest performing system, and then follow the content within Runner by Design to address that. And then we have the new 8-week pathway, which isn't yet finished, but it is called the Neuro Engine, and it's actually a full system which will take over the navigation as well. So everything will be in there. And the idea behind Neuro Engine is it basically takes this is all described in the onboarding course as well. So it basically takes in some questions that you need to answer, plus some new and improved assessments. That's why it's taken a bit longer, because I've rewritten it from the ground up. And so the assessments are more accurate, and they're looking for what I consider to be more important to improve your running. That's the kind of whole point with that. So that the assessments have been written and been calibrated, and that's taken quite a long time. But some of the walking gate ones still got to be done, but other than that, it's fine. So now I'm starting working on the interpretation layer. And so the interpretation layer will take the answers to your questions and your assessments that will automatically input into the Neuro Engine, and then it will produce that 8-week spine plan. And it'll give you 2 weeks of a plan, which you do, you reassess, it will then update the plan going forwards. So that's all quite exciting stuff. So that's all to come. And it's just literally down to how long it's taking me to calibrate everything, and the interpretation layer is probably going to be quite heavier as well, I would think. But once it's done, then it'll be pretty amazing. Just a reminder about annual memberships. Anyone who was on an annual membership, you either joined at the end of July or the very beginning of August. So just be aware that those memberships will renew. So if you don't want them to renew, just let me know. Or if you want to change over to a monthly subscription instead, just let me know. Either way, get in contact. Same goes if you feel that you're not getting value out of the membership, please let me know. Can it be changed to give you more value? Okay, that's really what I want is the feedback from you to make it valuable for you. Okay, so just a reminder about that. And obviously to say thank you very much for being in the membership for a year and supporting it for that full year that's been around. So I really do appreciate that support. Hopefully you've got that value back and more, hopefully. So main topics, fatigue and tension tonight. So what I thought I'd start off with is a paragraph that I thought was pretty apt. I think it's a really good paragraph actually. And it's one that I was digging in some stuff and coming up with rewording some bits and pieces and doing some research. And it basically says your system isn't breaking down, it's solving a problem. The output, whether it's tension, pain, altered gait, reduced range of movement, or fatigue, is the answer it has arrived at given the available information to it, okay, which is the important part. It's just that sometimes the answer is based on a flawed question or outdated data or a threat assessment that no longer reflects reality. Okay, so what it's basically saying is your system is trying to solve a problem. And whatever your output is, whether it's tension or fatigue or pain or changes in your movement pattern, that's the answer it's arrived at given the information that it has. Okay, so I want you to just bear that in mind as we kind of go through the rest of the call. So we're going to look at how fatigue impacts your running, and if there've been well, we'll still have the discussion, Mark, but it would have been better if you'd had. I'm not going to send you off in a room by yourself for 5 minutes. So I'm going to ask you then, you know, what do you think is fatigue? What's your interpretation of fatigue?
Can you hear me? Okay, I would say that fatigue for me is when the body starts to slow down, and the body starts to slow down and modifies actions to make your body's decisions more designed to be in line with what it needs to do. You wouldn't, effectively you'd be trying to your body be trying to find the easiest way of doing something, maybe not the right way. That's my basic understanding.
Okay, yep, and that's pretty good understanding. How does it impact you personally? What's your kind of personal experience of fatigue?
I just notice my body just starts, my whole body just feels heavier, and I don't feel as agile. My body movements become more lethargic.
Okay. So it's kind of loss of movement quality. Is the kind of premise.
Yeah.
And that can have other impacts, such as what, dropping pace, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what sort of things do you think you could do about that? How could you think you could improve fatigue? I suppose that's the other question.
From doing this course, I try to do like the piano fingers, like if I'm getting tired when I run, I've tried to do that. I try to do some visual stimulus as well. In my mind, it takes my mind off the fatigue, but I imagine you would say no, there's a reason why it does that. But I try to take my mind off the fatigue my body's feeling.
Yeah, no, that's a proven strategy. Some elite runners count backwards or count forwards. Mm-hmm. What both of those things are doing is they are firing up certain systems anyway. So doing the piano fingers is cerebellum, as well as some mm-hmm. other areas. Counting fires up other areas of the brain, so that actually can improve. So there's two ways of looking at this. So can you improve fatigue? You can improve your response to fatigue. You can, depending on your training and things like hydration, fueling, all that kind of stuff, you can maybe push fatigue out a little bit. So training is probably the primary one, adaptation for that. But then we can have the difference between capacity and being able to access that capacity. And so what you're doing by doing things like piano fingers and distraction and things like that, you're allowing your system to access that capacity for longer before things start to change. So that's kind of what that's doing, if you like, because you're tidying up some of the underlying systems.
Yeah.
So on with that, then, we want to look at kind of a reframe of the fatigue framework. Say reframing, because a lot of people do think fatigue is just you get tired, your body just can't cope anymore and you get tired, and that's kind of, don't have much more of an explanation. But we can actually look at this from a sort of neuroscience perspective whilst keeping it quite fairly sort of simple. So what we have here is we have basically an increased load. So fresh at the bottom, fatigued at the top. And then we have at the bottom when you're fresh, you have your best form. And I should probably really say your best current form, because you know, you might start a run in pain because you're already in pain. But when you're fresh, assuming you haven't just, you know, you aren't just fatigued, which of course you wouldn't be at this bottom, then you'd be somewhere up here. You know, if you just run 10 miles and then you want to do another 10 miles, you're not going to be at the bottom. So we're going to assume that when you're fresh, you've got your current best form. So for you, your current best form is, yeah, there's probably a little bit of stiffness still there, but you have got at least a higher percentage access to your capacity before you start to add any intensity to it. Okay, so when I say increasing load, that's increasing load. That could be speed, it could be actual load if you're carrying something, it could be time, you know, duration, it could be you know, any combination of those things. So it's just an increasing load on your system. Okay, and that's eventually what leads to kind of a state of fatigue. So what happens is then, as you start to get tired, as you start to go more forward with your running, the intensity increases, prediction and control get more expensive. So, you know, we're driven by predictive processing, and that is quite it's very energy efficient, but it becomes expensive because the control element starts to waver a little bit. Okay, so as you start to introduce a little bit of fatigue into the system, or if some of your underlying systems themselves aren't functioning very well, or aren't functioning as well as it could be, you start to lose a little bit of access to that capacity. And then what happens is your sensory quality starts to drop. And we saw that in that half marathon research, where exactly as you said there, as they start to get tired, as some of these things start to happen, they simplify their movements down. So instead of using their distal joints, such as their feet and their ankles, to do some of the fine motor control stuff, it gets simplified down to their bigger muscles. And you take more load on the hamstrings and around the pelvis, lower back and things like that, and you start to take that. So that starts to happen. So the inputs become less reliable, and then you start having a trust issue. So your brain starts to trust what's coming in less. So it has to start dealing with that. And one of the ways it does that is to increase that protective tone or that stiffness. So in your case, when you get to a point now where this has happened to a degree, okay, whoever's driving it, your protective tone increases in that glute, starts to stiffen up, and it gets uncomfortable. Okay, it's a safety compensation, and we'll talk about more of that when we actually get into that tension protective tone section. And then you start making compensation patterns. Okay, and you start to then say simplified movement is one of those compensation patterns, but there are others as well that might change. And all of this is, even though I've kind of drawn it as a hierarchy, it's actually a lot of it is kind of all happens either at the same time or not necessarily even in order. But you start getting a much higher threat level. So you've got an increased threat because your brain is now trying to work out what to do. Because what's happening now is all the predictive models, the predictive priors, which we'll kind of have a quick look at later, because the brain works in a top-down perspective. So it's trying to predict what's going to happen in this situation based on all the models it already has. And then the sensory information that's coming up is just either confirming or correcting that predictive prior. And so if there's a lot of error signals coming through, that's increasing overall threat because the brain's got to do something about that. It's either got to decide, actually, do you know what? I've got to slow you down. I've got to stiffen you up. I've got to do all of those things that you mentioned with fatigue, make you sluggish, to whatever, to get you into a place of more control by slowing it all down, stiffening you up, even though it's unpleasant for you. And we can get niggles, pain, tightness as a result of that. Because the brain goes, well, I need to deal with these error signals, and actually I don't really know what to do with it right now, so I'm just going to try and get you out of the situation. And you look at most stuff that's kind of you look at things like motion sickness, where it's a mismatch between vestibular sensory information and visual sensory information. It makes you sick because it wants to get you out of that situation. The threat level's too high. Okay, and then we have a loss of options. So things like your pace drops, your breathing might change, might become faster or more shallow. And some people, it kind of does the opposite. It gets deeper and deeper but less efficient. And then the form breaks down. And then any form stuff you might have had down at the bottom when you're in your best current form all get amplified. So if you've got form deficits down here or systems deficits down here, they're all going to get amplified up here. Okay, so you're going to have also coming in a lot of predictive priors that if you've been in this situation before that are kicking in and starting to become dominant. And that just eventually will lead to form collapse or breakdown. Okay. And in terms of predictive models, the more you stay in this loop and don't do anything about stuff, the stronger this model becomes. Okay. And we can look at it in a slightly different way. Oh, yeah. So this is fatigue, real or perceived. So real fatigue would be, we kind of talked about last time with Julia on the call where, you know, how long can you go? If you had adequate fueling, adequate hydration, all of that stuff was even, how long could your physicality, your physiology, your muscles actually work at a kind of sub threshold intensity? And, you know, it's about sort of 4 to 6 hours. That would be real fatigue. But perceived fatigue is comes in because the brain is these things are starting to build up. And so it introduces fatigue because it's got the same response as if it was real fatigue, but it's just happening much, much earlier on. Okay, and that's what Tim Noakes would call the central governor. I think it's now been certainly hypothesized anyway about peripheral governors. So it happens at a much more localized level as well as sort of centrally as well. So we can also have a look at it in here. So you're fresh, you're in your best current form. Prediction control get more expensive. Sensory quality starts to drop. Protective tone increases. And then I chuck another one in here, which is coordination then starts to degrade. So you might find your rhythm goes out, your timing goes out. And then that is a little loop in itself that can kind of downward spiral. Create these compensation patterns. You increase the threat. You have a lot of these movement options. And then you have this visible form breakdown and you feel it as well. I say visible because quite often when we look back at race photos or running photos and running videos, that's for a lot of us, that's the first time they notice it. When I do assessments with people and stick them on a treadmill and video them, that's the first time they've ever really seen themselves running. But of course you feel it before that, you know, you kind of feel that you're breaking down. Now what's interesting about this is at this level here, prediction and control, that's an input and processing function. Okay. So these gets expensive because the processing, the inputs around it and the processing is more expensive because it's got more work to do because it's less reliable information. This is also an input issue. Sensory quality starts to drop. Now that could be your visual, vestibular, proprioceptive, could be cerebellum, your motor control, timing, all that kind of stuff. It could be the proprioceptive stuff, which is joint sense. So if you've got, if you can't feel your feet properly, or, you know, for example, your big toe, that kind of goes into that. That becomes less reliable because you can't it can't rely necessarily on the information that's coming up from that toe in terms of where the ground is. So it has to do that a different way. Okay. And this is where these things come in. Because all of these things now, these are all outputs. Okay, so these are all the end result, these are all the cake after it's baked. Okay. These ones here are the input. So if you want to influence any of these things, you do it by training these things here. Okay. That's the only way that you can train these other things. Okay. By trying to train any of these directly, sometimes it can work, but it's because you're indirectly actually training this stuff. But it just takes a long time and it's the wrong way around, which is why most of the traditional stuff is very hit and miss and doesn't work for an awful lot of people. The people it tends to work for already have quite a high degree of these two things, but there's something just a little bit off. Or they've indirectly hit the right thing for that person, which also happens as well. But it's not necessarily deliberate. Okay, so that makes sense.
Yeah, makes sense.
So basically, as your inputs and processing degrade, your outputs change, and your form breaks down, and that can result in pains and niggles, stiffness and tension, excessive fatigue, drop in pace, et cetera, all those things that we experience that we put down to basically anything else other than inputs and processing. You know, we say, oh yeah, you know, I've got this pain, we need to get knee pain. Well, why have I got knee pain? Now, what have I done to my knee? Well, it's more the fact that it's been asked to do stuff it can't handle because there's something wrong at this level here. Okay. So, your overall goal as a runner, my overall goal as a coach, and the overall goal of Runner by Design and the whole neuroactive method is to help you keep access to your capacity for as long as possible. And I'll give you an example of that. As I'm currently coaching a youth athlete, 16, 17 years old, and he's been, I may have spoken to him about it on the last, I can't remember the last live call. He's been trying to beat, get underneath 2 minutes for 800 meters. That's pretty fast. And he came to me because I know him from the track, came to me to ask my advice about how he could do that from a sort of neuro perspective. I don't give him his coaching sessions. He has a coach for that down at Bournemouth. And so I said, okay, well, I get an assessment. And what we discovered is for him, he was losing access to that capacity, even in 800 meters. So even in 2 minutes, and I think it was 2 minutes and 5 seconds at the time he was there or thereabouts. And he was getting closer and closer, but he wasn't really getting to that point. So when I did my assessment on him, what we discovered was that his ability to do what's called fixed eye VORs, visual ocular reflex, doing head turns, but very, very fast head turns, wasn't there, along with some other bits and pieces, and some cerebellar stuff as well. So when you're moving that fast, you're basically, your head is moving, even though it's imperceptible to you, but your system has to handle about 360 beats per minute of effectively head shaking, which is pretty quick. Oh, where are we? Metronome. That doesn't help, does it? It's on the wrong thing. So that's basically doing that at that speed. Okay. What he can now do after training with me, he can now read a sheet of A4 paper with just random letters on it at that speed. He can do that with his head and read all the letters and read them perfectly, not make a single mistake. So now he's able to access that capacity for that integration between his visual system and his vestibular system at that kind of oscillation when he's running. So he got underneath 2 minutes for 800 meters, done really well. But now his next goal is he's got to get under, I think it's 409 for 1500 meters. So his goal has changed. So now he needs to keep that access to that capacity for longer. That's a slightly slower oscillation because he's not going to be running overall fast, but he's going further into that fatigue thing. So he now needs to keep access to that capacity for longer. And then his goal after that is to get a certain time for 3000, a certain time for 5000. He's trying to do it all at the same time, which obviously is very difficult to do because, you know, that's just really hard at that kind of level. But this is what that keeping that capacity is for us, mere mortals. It means that we want to carry on enjoying our running. We still need to keep access to our capacity for as long as possible. And there may be extra capacity we need to develop, and that's fine. But we know we need to be able to keep access to it as we start to get tired. As some of these other systems start to kind of degrade, other systems should be good enough to be able to pick some of that up so we can get further into a run or a race or work at a higher intensity and it doesn't affect us in the same way. So you can almost look at it like maybe we can't do anything about the fatigue itself, but we can do something about how we carry on accessing our skills to that point where real fatigue kicks in. And that's what I used to call skill endurance. I suppose still a pretty good term. When you look at professional marathon runners, when they finish a marathon, even though they might have come in under 2 hours, they still look like they could go out and do it again. There are a few that land on the floor, but it's not for very long. Obviously, they couldn't do it again, but that's skill endurance. Whereas a lot of recreational runners, when they cross the finish line of a marathon, are absolutely gone. And that shows you how much that's degraded and they're just hanging on, which is something we'll kind of look at in a bit as well. So does that make kind of sense?
Yeah, total sense.
So kind of in your situation, what's happening is you're losing capacity to some of that skill or some of those underlying systems quite quickly. And the response of your system is to create tension. that's kind of what it's doing. Unfortunately, sometimes it's a bit of an unraveling process. So the core message of this is that running breaks down when control is lost. And your form isn't something you hold together. It's something that your system produces automatically up to a certain point. I mean, you can do. So in a race situation, you can do things like the piano fingers and other stuff to get you to the end of that. However, I would say, though, that if you're doing that on every run just to get you through to the end of the run, there's definitely something else underlying in the system that you need, that should be trained out. Okay, because when fatigue rises, control drops, output changes. Okay, we saw that kind of quite clearly. So if you're trying to do some neural hacks, so neural drivers, call them whatever you want, those piano fingers, lots of distraction all the time, you're doing it all the time in any kind of training run, easy runs, whatever, then there's definitely a system on, you know, a systems deficit somewhere that needs to be, you know, addressed. Because trying to fix technique in the moment is actually adding more interference into the system. So it's adding more load when the system's already overloaded. So it's not kind of improving it. But I would say if you're in a race situation or you're just trying to get that last end bit of a run, maybe you're running an extra few kilometers than you normally would. That's slightly different because you're using it to help push that process of adaptation. But if it's quite a regular thing, then it's kind of like, well, maybe I need to go back and actually train those systems better so this doesn't happen. So questions about that section?
No, it's straightforward for me.
Good. So the next one then is tension and protective tone. So again, I'll have a little bit of discussion about this. I'll just ask you some questions, really. So obviously, we've spoken about this quite a lot, but what is kind of what's your experience of tension and stiffness?
What, for me physically?
Yeah.
from our conversations, clearly the pain I'm feeling in my glute, I mean, that's got to be fundamentally, that's where I'm getting I'm not quite sure whether that's where I'm getting the tension or is that just a weak spot, which I'd always focus on because it's up here now that it's the issue there.
Yeah, interesting. Well, I'm actually we'll cover that when we look at some of the mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting, very interesting point. And on that, actually, if I share, I just want to share, first of all, I wonder if I can share that. This, hopefully I can share this. I'll stop sharing that for a second and then see if I can share this one here. So that's quite a classic startle response. Okay. And given that for most people, that would be kind of an innocuous kind of exercise to do, it's just a smooth pursuit. You can see how much of a threat that is to you, moving your eyes across that direction. But you can see all the tension in your neck.
Yeah.
If I stop sharing that for a minute, and then hopefully it'll let me share the actual video. Now, I know this was a while ago, so it may have changed since then. So this is the actual video. So you can see how much tension you've got in your head, your neck, and your upper body, and your body actually rotates a little bit, your head and neck rotates with the pen as it's moving across, rather than just your eyes.
Yeah,
particularly in there, that direction there was kind of the worst one. Mm. So it's not a nice, you know, smooth pursuit across.
Yeah,
it's quite, you know, it's quite.
Now you put it out. I remember when I was doing that, I just felt that I had to keep really tensed up in the upper body just to be able to focus on moving the eyes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. So you're basically, what you're doing is you're stabilizing in order to do that. But we can see the same thing in this one here. Oh, why's it done that? That's a bit weird. How come I opened that early and it's absolutely fine? I open it now and it's at an angle. That makes no sense. Makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. Okay, let's... Oh, so it's now opening all your videos sideways. That's really helpful, isn't it? Why is it doing that? Yeah, okay, don't know. Well, I can't share it sideways. That's a bit weird. Yeah, not sure. Okay, well, let's go. That's very bizarre. But you could see there, in terms of tension and kind of how that relates to kind of what you just said about what you just kind of said about.
When you pointed it out then, I do include an exercise, and I just remember I found it really difficult and I had to really tense myself up to be able to follow it.
But if that's happening when you're running, then it's quite feasible that your glute is the weak spot, because it's maybe related to that toe as well, because the glute and the toe is quite closely related. But if you're creating that much tension whenever your eyes have to move when you're running, you can see that it's going to put pressure in places or stress on places, load on places that maybe are not designed to take that load. In a way, it's not designed to take it. And so your system does is it simplifies everything down. It creates a load of tension to stabilize because it goes, I don't know what to do here, so I'm just going to stabilize. I don't like this lack of integration between what my vestibular system is telling me about orientation and what my eyes are telling me, because really they can't move without the rest of me moving. So it's not really aware. So how do I do that? Well, I stabilize my middle in order for that to happen. And then that just puts, you know, inefficiency in terms of movement fluidity.
Through. Yeah.
Okay. So we can skip the other question because you kind of know, you understand more about this than lots of other people. But if you were to go to a physio or you go to a lot of these professionals, what they'll probably tell you is, yeah, you've got tight muscles. Yeah, it's this that's causing the tightness. But what we have to realize about any form of tension is it's a protective mechanism. And again, I'll just bring this paragraph back up again, that it's, you know, it's trying to solve a problem. So your system is trying to solve a problem by adding that tension in. And so one of the questions we have to ask is what is the problem it's trying to solve? Because your nervous system is never wrong, given what it knows. Okay. The work is always about improving what it knows. So tension isn't a failure state, as we've just seen. It's an answer to a problem. And we have to ask, you know, what question is your nervous system trying to answer? Okay. So given what it knows, improving what it knows. So if you've got outdated predictive models, if your sensory maps aren't up to date, your body maps aren't up to date, then you know it's working off old information or incorrect information. So the only things it can do is to react to that and provide an answer to that, which in your case is lots of tension and eventually some pain. Mm-hmm. So we kind of talked a lot about the threat of the input side, really, and running by design. That's the whole. A lot of it is based on that. It's all about the systems level performance, visual, vestibular, proprioceptor, cerebellum, and the integration between those. And that is really my total interest is this, because I think there's an awful lot said about the other stuff, but not very much said about this. However, I want to also talk about some of the other things, because it does feed into the same thing. There is a neurological side of everything else as well. So the first thing I want to look at is the output side. So your brain protects against demands that it doesn't believe it can meet. I mean, all of this is neurological at some level, but it's reacting to, or it's predicting for this. Okay, so things like speed, gradient, duration, load. If any of these things exceed what your brain predicts, it can safely execute. Okay, it can create tension of a way of down sort of regulating everything, and it's kind of like a preemptive break. So let's just say you're coming up to the bottom of a hill and it goes, oh, I hate hills. I don't know. I can't do this. That's a problem that I suffer from still at the moment since COVID, because I have a very strong predictive model about really how horrible it was running any kind of hill. And I'm finding that really difficult to train out in my system at the moment. I've made some progress, but it's just so entrenched in my system that, it's there. And so that would be a kind of threat from the output side, because although it's input in terms of prediction, it's definitely reflected from an outside perspective. And in that case, my brain is kind of going, the expected demands of running up that hill in any way other than just jogging up it is way more than my brain thinks I can do, whether I can in reality or not. Okay, so it's all about that perception. So another example would be, you know, a runner being at kind of mile 18 of a marathon, and the pace required to hit their goal time, or let's say 3 hours, 58 minutes, is a 9:05 pace, which is about 5:39 minute kilometer pace. And their brain, monitoring their accumulated fatigue, the hydration, the glycogen depletion, so the fueling, the heart rate trajectory, and all of that, it calculates that sustaining that output is beyond the predicted safe capacity. Okay, so all these things are happening all the time with all of your systems. Okay, so before the runner makes any form of conscious decision, the system's already taken care of it. So the hamstrings start to tighten up, the hip flexors begin to stiffen, their stride length shortens, all this simplification starts to happen, and the runner feels like they're hitting the wall, even though they've not been, you know, haven't been injured, they don't have any tissue issues. The brain is simply putting on the preemptive brake, because the demand is exceeding its predicted safe ceiling. And again, this comes back to Tim Noakes' central governor theory and the peripheral governor theory. But this kind of explains the mechanics of it, or the neuromechanics of it in that sense, as to why, you know, that happens. Because it's making all these predictions and goes, well, you know, I don't think based on what my monitoring is saying, I can meet that demand. So I've got to slow you down or stiffen you up, sort of thing. Okay. Does that
make sense?
So we've also got energy, resource, and allocation. So your brain is monitoring your metabolic cost all of the time. And tension can be a sort of conservative response to that if it thinks that you're going to use up those resources too quickly. So if your current trajectory is going to exceed your safe resource limits, then stiffening and slowing can reduce that consumption, because your brain is an energy conservation machine. Your survival is its primary goal, and one of the ways it does that is by reducing the amount of energy. Because if your body's using all the energy, it goes, well, hang on a minute, there's no energy for my brain, so I've got to reduce the energy somewhere else so that your brain gets all of that energy, because it uses upwards of 25% of your daily energy expenditure. So we call this predicted sustainability. Okay, so it's always predicting, can I do this? Can I sustain based on what I'm doing? And we can improve this through training. We can improve it through all the other things that we do, you know, things like fueling, hydration, all this kind of stuff as well. That can have a big impact on this. Things that also impact it, things like the weather, for example, can massively impact it as well, because that will change the prediction of what the brain thinks is possible. So an example of this could be that a runner goes out too fast on a 10K. First couple of miles are fine, but they're running a little bit quicker than their threshold pace. So they're now in that, they're kind of mid to upper threshold zone. So you basically go out too fast. By mile four, although they're muscularly, physiology wise, they're fine, they begin to notice that their muscles are starting to increase in tightness. So the quads are starting to get tight, starting to get a little bit heavy, and there's a subtle, but you know, it's kind of what you were saying there, persistent reluctance in their legs to turn over freely, so they start to get heavy legs. And while there's no structural threat, i.e. there's no injury, no tissue issue, again their brain has calculated that the resource trajectory is unsustainable, so it starts to use tension and reduced stride efficiency to forcibly reduce consumption and bring the energy budget back down towards what's viable. Okay, so that's kind of very resource based. And then we have the faulty and stale predictive priors. So the predictive prior itself can be the problem. So predictive prior is the predictive model that we have when we build up thousands of these over our lifetime from our personal experiences, from what we read, from what we hear, you know, what people teach us, what we believe. It's called a prior because it's a model that already exists. And the model itself can be the problem, because you can have good quality data coming in, so you can have tidied up some of your visual system coming in. But because you've got an old model, so for example, when I'm running up a hill, I could have still have good information. Nothing's changed physically. I can, my vision hasn't changed. None of that's changed. There may be some vestibular stuff going on actually a little bit, but all the ice is fine. But I've got a very strong predictive model that hills to me are a massive struggle and they're painful and I really don't like them. So that affects me. But you can have outdated movement maps. So the movement maps that you have, that your brain has, are outdated. So things like phantom limb syndrome, this is where this comes from. So the movement map has never been updated because in that case, it's very difficult to update it, which is where mirror box therapy comes in. But we can also have it that, you know, following injury, this is quite common as well. So your brain basically is running a predictive model for the wrong current body. It's running a model for the body it thinks it has, but actually the model, the body in reality is something different from that. Okay, so it's the wrong body it's running it for. And this comes back to the whole kind of controlled hallucination thing. Your brain can only make decisions on the information it has. It cannot make decisions on the information it does not have. Okay, so that's why it's our job to make sure it has all the information it needs. Okay. So you can have clean inputs coming in, but they're compared to old models, which produces lots of error signals. And what your brain does is, well, I don't know what to do with these. I'm just going to create tension instead. So it creates that tension instead of trying to deal with it. The way to deal with it would be to do lots of movement map updates and improving that quality without stress. So you've got to start off doing it in a non-stressful situation, and then you start to put it into your running, which is why in that 12-week movement challenge, we start off with weeks 1 to 4, move, lots of move, daily moving, getting used to that. That's updating the movement maps. And then we start to add in other systems in there, you know, foot positions, head positions, eye positions, because then that's building better movement maps. But it's also starting to add in some vestibular and visual works as well. And then we start to put it into a running context. Okay. But we only put it into a running context once you've got a foundation for the other stuff. So although that, you know, the presentation of that 12-week challenge might not be, you know, could be updated, the actual design of it has been very well thought out. You know, I designed it specifically so it follows this path. So, you know, what we're not trying to do is we're not, you know, we're not trying to have nice clean inputs but old models. We're trying to update the models, or actually the research is now telling us it's not necessarily updating the models, it's creating new models that then become dominant. That's what we want to do with that. So we have to update what your brain knows, and then it's got better information or more helpful information. So does that make sense?
Yeah, makes sense.
So an example of this might be a runner who returns from a 12-week Achilles injury. So the injury is fully healed up, so there's no tissue issue. Okay, but for the last 12 weeks, their brain has been basically running a movement map built around protecting that tendon. So it's been a restrictive movement map, and it's restrictive movement necessary to, you know, protect it through shortened stride, reduced push off, and slightly altered foot strike. So the map is now, that's now the dominant prior because it's been used for 12 weeks continuously. So there's a strong kind of neural pathway for it. So on their first few runs back, after the injury is healed up, once we're allowed to go back, despite there's now, in theory, proprioceptive input from the tendon, I think there probably would still be maybe some skin stretch that hasn't been, if they've not, depends on the rehab they do. Most physios won't do things like skin stretch rehab or that type of sensory rehab. They're just moving on mechanoreceptive, which is like things like, you know, ankle movements and bits of loading and stuff like that, which is all really good stuff. But you have to add on to that as well. Okay, so they generally speaking got much cleaner proprioceptive input, but the brain keeps generating an error signal because the incoming data doesn't match the predictive model, which is now outdated, that is designed to give protection around that tendon. So the result, therefore, this person experiences is stiffness and guarding around the Achilles and calf, even though the tissue is fine. And the map hasn't caught up with the territory. And that's, I think, in some of your case, that might be applying to you as well. Yeah, there's probably an element to that as well, probably your toe level and probably a lot of it up that whole left-hand side level, I would think, to a certain degree. And then we have the next one, which you alluded to earlier, which is emotional and contextual threat loading. Mm-hmm. So this is the fact that your brain doesn't evaluate movement in isolation. It, in the context itself, can carry threat. And the examples I give here is like a race or fear of injury or re-injury. So when you're going out running, at the back of your mind, and that got worse and worse and worse as things didn't improve, was that, am I going to re-injure myself? And you start to question, actually, is there a tissue injury there? Even though you know there's not, you think, is there something there? Am I going to re-injure myself? And that has a, that itself creates a massive threat level. Then you have your unfamiliarity, your unfamiliar terrain. Are you running on terrain you've never run on before? That can cause a threat level. Are you running in unfamiliar surroundings? Are you running in a city you've never run in before, with people you don't run with normally? You know, all this can create that kind of emotional contextual threat loading. And then you have like social evaluation as well. You know, are people watching me? Are people judging me? That sort of thing. So, and this is sort of prediction is triggered upstream. Okay, so this is, whereas the other ones so far from 2 down to 4 have kind of been more downstream. Okay, so more closer to the physicality or the output side of things, shall we say. This is very much like the input system. So this is much higher upstream. It's kind of in that limbic or cortical system. Okay, cortex being the higher order brain. Because your system doesn't really distinguish between, oh, my right ankle might give out, and I'm being watched and judged. It treats those two things in an emotional, contextual way in exactly the same. So the safety response, in this case, creating tension, is the same. Okay, so if you think you know, we'll give you an example in a minute, but yeah, it's exactly the same kind of, I thought I was going to say there in terms of this, but it's it doesn't judge between them. And we know what I was going to say was the brain, areas of the brain that are involved in movement quality are also involved in thought quality. So if you have an underperforming cerebellum, which affects your timing, rhythm, motor control, accuracy and error checking of your movements, that also affects all of those things to do with your thought processing as well. So your emotional processing, your thought processing can be affected by these brain areas. So just something to kind of bear in mind that actually that whole side of thing plays in is very tightly integrated. So an example for this could be a club runner who trains well all week, lines up at their local park run, which in effect is a low stakes 5K, but notice that they're being watched by a faster runner that they want to impress or that they feel they maybe aspire to being like. And within the first 400 meters, their shoulders are raised, their jaw is clenched, and their arm carry is tighter than usual. They're basically creating a lot of tension. Nothing has changed. They've still got access to all of that capacity, or they did have. The capacity part hasn't changed, certainly, within 400 meters of the run. So nothing has changed from their kind of Tuesday night training run, but the social evaluation context has kicked in, and it's raised that overall threat level. And the motor output is then kind of being downregulated through increased tension. So before any physical challenges even presented itself, so they're only 400 meters, only 400 meters into that race. So it can have a huge impact. You know, you see it in other contexts as well, such as, you know, elite athletes can perform very well in all circumstances. You stick them in the Olympics, and suddenly it's too big a stage, is the way they would classify that. But it's the same thing. Okay, suddenly their system sees that as a massive threat level and starts to introduce tension in there. So you can kind of see that. Unraveling tension can be really quite difficult, and there's probably, with most people, elements of all of these in there somewhere along the line, because they all feed into each other. Now, I want to talk about cerebellum timing and prediction errors, because even though I classify cerebellum as the systems level, that kind of input processing level, which it is, because the cerebellum is the integration hub. So it's very, very important for runners. It's hugely important. I wanted to just bring out the timing aspect of it, because timing predictions can cause issues as well. So if the cerebellar function is compromised, the time predictions that it issues out to muscular contractions, etc., they can arrive late, and they might be inaccurate. Okay, so this can impact things like your anticipatory postural adjustments. Remember, your whole system is predicting moment ahead of your conscious awareness. By the time you've consciously adjusted something, your predictive system has moved on to the next bit already before that. Okay, so you're always adjusting you're always one behind what your system is doing. And if you're always arriving late, a conscious adjustment is not necessarily going to impact or can have a negative impact on the next step, because the next step has already gone out of sync already and you're trying to make an adjustment for it. So it can be a never-ending loop, really. And it can affect this limb sequencing as well. So if you feel uncoordinated, that's often a cerebellar issue. Well, it is a cerebellar issue more often than not, but it's a timing issue. So as you start to get more fatigued, as the load or intensity increases, these things start to happen more and expose these errors much, much more. So this can be a really big problem for runners in particular. I think if runners were to concentrate on just one thing, if someone said to me, right, you can only do runner by design, design it around one thing, it would be the cerebellum. Because I think the cerebellum is so important for everything we do as runners, all that motor control, all that timing. You know, running is basically rhythmic. That's what it is. It's all about timing. And if you've got rubbish timing, either internal or external or both, then running can be a real challenge for you. Coordination is huge. Having said that, I do know people who, I think coordination is quite context driven. Some people can be quite good runners, but be uncoordinated in other areas. But generally speaking, you would expect them to be coordinated across the board. So attention is one way to make the outcome more controllable, more predictable, more reliable. Okay, so you take out the element of prediction errors by just locking everything down. Therefore, you can't have a prediction, less prediction errors, because there's less moving parts effectively. You reduce it all down so it's much, much more predictable. And I think that's happening with you. We know by looking at those previous assessment videos that there are cerebellar challenges. So I would have shown you if that video hadn't stuck you sideways as well, because you create a lot of tension because your cerebellum is trying to work out how to accurately do a movement. And the only way it can do it is either to slow it right down or to do it very deliberately rather than fluidly. So this is a huge one. This is a massive one. So example of this might be a runner with a history of ankle sprains and associated degraded proprioceptive input from the ankle. So they're not getting the right sensory input coming in. And they begin to show subtle timing disruption in their gait. Okay. So the cerebellum, which relies on that accurate information coming back to it, because what basically cerebellum does is it takes the movement strategy, sends it out to the musculature, and then it relies on the information coming back to say, is what's happening the same as what's planned? If not, I need to adjust it. Okay, that's the error correction side of things. But in this case, it's working with incomplete data. Okay, so it can't issue these precise sort of anticipatory postural commands. So the timing of, say, the glute activation, okay, which is kind of relevant for you, is ahead of the foot strike, okay, and it begins to drift. So what it's supposed to do, the timing of the glute activation being ahead of the foot strike begins to drift, therefore there's a synchronization issue. Even more an issue if this happens on one side and not the other, or more on one side than another. So what the brain does is experiencing the movement as less predictable than it should be. It responds by increasing the overall stiffness through the hip and the lower limb. Okay, so effectively reducing degrees of freedom to make the output more controllable, more reliable, more predictable. Okay, which is exactly what's happening in your situation. So the runner presents as generally tight through the hip or the glute, but the origin is a cerebellar timing error driven by poor ankle proprioception, not a hip problem at all. So in your case, it's a combination potentially of visual vestibular integration, cerebellar timing, and then that toe's probably not helping it because then it's not getting that error correction feedback down there as well. So what we're having then is that poor toe proprioception, and it's all being collected at your glute and all that stiffness around your glute, because that's an area either brain has decided that's where it's going to warn you about it all and say, right, Mark, you've got to slow down because you're not continuing doing this because it's really unsafe. So it makes your glute sore because that's what it's chosen to do. Sometimes you don't really know why it does that, but it does do that. Okay, so does that kind of
make sense? Yeah, it does sense. Make sense, yeah.
So in summary then, for tension. So tension is your nervous system's preferred tool for reducing uncertainty in a high-stakes output system. So whether the uncertainty comes from bad inputs or poor inputs or unhelpful inputs, whichever way you want to put that, a faulty map or faulty maps. You have lots of them around the place and they have to kind of synchronize in some ways, or it's a threatening context or a depleted internal state, or it's a timing prediction error. The solution that your brain reaches for is the same: stiffen, slow down, reduce the degrees of movement, and introduce pain. Okay, not necessarily all of them, not necessarily in the same ratio, and not necessarily in that order. Okay, because it will take whatever it needs to do to warn you to get out of that situation. It wants something to change. Okay, so that's why we get tension. Well, I say in a running environment, but that's why we get tension anywhere. You know, it's why we get sore backs, sore shoulders, all this kind of stuff. This is why all this happens, because your brain is trying to answer a question, trying to solve a problem, and tension is one of the best ways. Tension and pain, I think, are probably the two best ways it tries to do that, because it's got to stabilize stuff to allow you to continue doing what you want to do, albeit less fluently and perhaps in a little bit of pain. So this is why addressing tension requires working upstream. Okay, inputs, processing. So that's on the source of the uncertainty, which is tends to be where it is, okay, not on the tension itself. And again, that's the difference when you go to see a physio or a massage therapist. Unless they have this type of training, they're not working on the upstream of that. And in fact, I don't think I've ever been to I've never personally been to a physio or a massage therapist or anybody else who has said, okay, let's just do some eye work because that's going to help you release some of that tension. More often than not, they'll say, oh, you've got stiff muscles because of this. You might have something else, but they try and deal with the tension itself, either with hands-on work, which can help, but it's normally temporary because they're not solving the problem. They're dealing with some of the symptoms and they're giving novel input, in which case, now sometimes it does work, in which case whatever they did affected the upstream, because no matter which way you look at it, it's always an upstream issue. But you can solve it sometimes by, you know, accidentally hitting the right place. Any questions about that? Anything that needs to be clarified or?
No, I'm happy with that. Very tough. Well, you've explained it very well. So I'm kind of like understanding now. And I'm sat here feeling all like I'm just full of tension.
Yeah, exactly. And it kind of occurred to me the other day when I was speaking to you, say, you know, some of the things I was like thinking about, how can I get you to relax? And the thing is, if your system's in high alert, it's very hard for you to consciously relax. Mm-hmm. Breathing might help. Yeah. That is one thing that calms down the central nervous system. But the biggest thing that's going to help you reduce that tension is dealing with some of these systems level issues. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of going, okay, doing some of the eye work in a non-threatening way. So instead of maybe, and this is what we do, if you do assessment videos from updated ones, we'll have a look at that and we'll do, but it might involve things like doing, you know, a much smaller range.
Yeah.
For example, of doing some of the eye work, it might be, okay, can I, you know, differentiate my neck from my head and do some very small range, you know, vestibular training stuff, head and eyes, or just head or eyes, you know, so things like that. So we're starting to introduce it slowly, and adding some breathing in with that as well. So we're starting to stack a little bit in terms of how we're approaching it. I'm going to take it that way. We try and unravel it that way, brain safety. And then kind of, it's challenging because in your job, you need to create tension. Mm-hmm. So it's not about not creating tension. It's about making that tension appropriate for when it needs to be created.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Was that helpful?
It was very helpful. Yeah. Yeah.
Good. Excellent.
Sort things out in my head. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just things to reflect on and noticing that self-awareness part of it.
Yeah.
Is just super important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You might not be able to do very much about it, but having an awareness, oh yeah, I am tense all the time.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe I can just do some breathing four in, six out, or even four in, four out, just do a little bit of box breathing or similar to box breathing, just to see, okay, does that allow me to allow tension out. One of the things I used to do was I would just sit there and breathe and close my eyes and just think, okay, can I create tension in my scalp and can I let it go? Can I create tension in my head and let it go, in my neck? Some of the things, it's just you have to imagine it, because you actually can't do it. But it's that imagining, it's that connecting, is helping to update those brain body maps as well.
Yeah.
So just some bits and pieces, and you might find actually do what's really difficult to do. You might find actually that really helps.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, it helps you become aware of, oh, actually I'm holding tension here, there, or whatever it might be. And actually I can focus on it a little bit more and just allow some of it to go. Even though it means you have to create more tension initially to allow it then to relax.
Yeah. Yeah. I get that.
And I'm, you know, I'm working with somebody at the moment who just plays a lot of rugby, and this is the kind of stuff working on, because he uses a lot of his tension is in his back all the time. And actually, he didn't come in for that at all. He came in for running, but actually ended up that he made such massive progress with his hip pain and everything else in the first few weeks of working together. He goes, right, okay, well, I'll just let's carry on and just keep on going. And this has allowed him, and he couldn't play rugby, couldn't do anything because he was so in so much pain, and now can. He plays rugby.
Oh, wow.
Quite a lot now. And so we've kind of moved past that initial, and his hips have been fine. So he's removed that past that initial bit. As he's doing more, he's now finding other things. This whole thing about capacity.
Yeah.
And so that's now his big thing that's holding him back is that he creates a lot of tension in his back. And it's some of his underlying systems, some of it's habitual.
Mm.
You know, the predictors, very strong predictive priors, that he's finding it really hard to get himself out of that pattern of movement. So we have to just take it very slowly, very, you know, body awareness.
Yeah.
So, and he can do it once he's aware of it. But, it, you know, it's getting it to that, so it's unconscious.
Yeah.
So he doesn't hold himself up in that way.
Yeah.
Cool. Excellent. Well, anything else?
No, that's it. That's good. Thank you.
Perfect. Well, thank you very much for being on the call, Mark. Hopefully that's recorded the presentation as well. Yeah. If not, I'll have to just release the video and then redo the presentation like I did that first time.
Okay.
Because it's a bit of a different platform, but I mean, it won't affect the audio version, so that's fine. That'll be the same. But I might have to do a second recording of it, but we'll see. Wonderful. I'll stop that recording now. How do I do this? Stop recording. Cool. Excellent. Okay. Thank you very much, Mark.
Cheers, Chris. Thanks
for that. Really appreciate it. Yeah. I look forward to just getting the videos from you just whenever you get a chance.
Yeah. Okay. Wonderful. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
All right.
Cheers. Thanks, Mark. Cheers. Bye.